Welcome to the City Club of Eugene's April 21st, 2017 program, Our Representative Democracy. Can it survive? With U.S. Representative Peter DeFazio. This is the 28th program in the current programming 2016-2017 year. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, City Club Board President. The City Club brings together civic-minded people to make Eugene a better place to live, work, and play. We are a member-supported organization. Today's program is coordinated by our very own Sandy Erickson in partnership with the Wayne Morse Center for Law and Politics. Congressman DeFazio will speak on our representative democracy, can it survive? A topic recently much discussed in Congress as the nation approaches 100 days in office of the new administration. From the Watergate era to today, Representative DeFazio will trace the origins of campaign finance reform, the rise of dark money, and the impact these developments have on recent elections and other topics. Congressman Peter DeFazio was first elected to the U.S. Congress in 1986 and is now the longest serving House member in Oregon history. In 2014, Representative DeFazio was elected to the position of ranking member on the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee, which has jurisdiction over the Coast Guard, highway and transit, water resources, railroads, aviation, and economic development. Wow. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Congressman Peter DeFazio.
Well, thanks. It's the Easter break, and I've been home and did five town halls and a couple of community forums around my district, and it's been a great relief to be out of Washington. I first gave this speech in slightly different form last year, the McCall Lecture at Oregon State, but obviously a few things have changed since that time. It's been updated a little bit. You know, I don't think it's any surprise to anybody in this room that politicians are very unpopular, and very few people have faith that our elected officials and our system of government is going to address their real concerns. Recent poll from Gallup says 24% of the American public approves of the job Congress is doing. 24%. It's not only how Congress is performing, but it's also people are very cynical about the way people get to Congress or get elected. A new poll from Ipsos shows that Americans think the presidential nominating system is rigged. 66% of Americans think the wealthy have a better chance to influence the election's outcome than others. They're right. And half, including myself, say we need to completely rebuild our campaign finance system. Discontent, in part, is what led to the election of Donald Trump. Blow it all up and maybe it'll get better because it's not working the way it is. First, a few basics. Most people probably know it, but basics on campaign finance, because this is one of the key points I want to make. Every candidate for federal office has a campaign committee for campaign staff, advertising, running an office, et cetera. Individual donations to those committees are limited to $2,700 by an individual per election cycle and $5,000 from a political action committee. And then the party committees can also assist to a certain, they are limited in the amount of money they can spend directly, but they can spend unlimited money on party building. Then, of course, we have political action committees. They are organizationally based, issue-based, or created by a politician. But PACs, political action committees, have to disclose their donors and their expenditures, so you can at least keep track of them. Now that we understand the basics, let's look at the history and where we're at today. First, we start with Watergate. Congress passed sweeping campaign finance reforms. Contributions to political candidates for individuals are strictly limited. On top of that, spending by independent expenditures outside groups was limited to $1,000. In '76, That independent spending limit was struck down in the Supreme Court in the case of Buckley versus Vallejo. The court determined that this was a violation of the First Amendment and that it was limiting free speech. That basically was the beginning to cracking open the floodgates and where we are today in the post-Citizens United world. We'll get to that in a minute. In my opinion, the Citizens United decision was an extraordinary example of judicial activism. It's one of the most damaging decisions in our nation's history. I'd rank it up there with Dred Scott, which upheld slavery, Plessy versus Ferguson, separate but equal. Ultimately, we overcame those things, but Citizens United is threatening the very core of our representative democracy. And the Supreme Court heard a case that wasn't before it. It was a very simple case. They heard it. And then Justice Roberts said, I think we ought to expand the scope and hear it again, which is extraordinarily unusual. They did. Unbelievable judicial activism. They overturned numerous Supreme Court precedents, 100 years of settled law in the decision. It ruled that unions and corporations can spend unlimited sums of money on elections, and those donations were as protected under the First Amendment as free speech. It also bestowed personhood on corporations. Recent polls show that 73% of the people in the United States have an unfavorable opinion of that decision compared to 18% who favor it. Before this decision, corporations and unions were prohibited from making independent expenditures and creating their own committees to finance election communications. In the Citizens United decision, Justice Kennedy said, independent expenditures, including those made by corporations, do not give rise to corruption or the appearance of corruption. Now, in Washington, appearances seems like it's kind of the key. The concern isn't over whether something is ethical or corrupting the system. It's just we can't have an appearance of impropriety. In Buckley versus Vallejo, the court concluded the avoidance of the appearance of improper influence is also critical if confidence in the system of representative government is not to be eroded to a disastrous extent. We've got those so-called safeguards in place, and it's clear to me that confidence in our government is at near record lows. Yet I just finished filling out my annual financial disclosure, very meticulous, filling out everything I have. My wife has a retirement fund. If she moves from one publicly traded mutual fund to another, that has to be reported because I might have some inside information on how the mutual fund market is moving. But somehow, Tom Price, our new Secretary of Health and Human Services, introduced legislation that impacted pharmaceutical and device manufacturers. He was given an opportunity to purchase before market IPO from one of those companies that was impacted by his legislation. Yet that's just fine. He's now a cabinet member because he reported it. It doesn't seem that way to me. But while we have this appearance of, it's ethical because he reported it. That's not exactly getting to the root cause of some of the problems we have in D.C. But now, Citizens United led to super PACs. I was the first member of Congress to be attacked by a super PAC by what was then kind of an anonymous Wall Street billionaire named Bob Mercer, who is now the principal behind Donald Trump, or his daughter is, with his money. And super PACs can raise and spend unlimited amounts of money. Theoretically, they can't donate directly to political candidates. They're their own entities. But as the New York Times editorial board said, super PACs are supposedly independent of the candidate's campaign. But that distinction has just about vanished. And they are required to disclose their donors. But donors now are using shell corporations based in Delaware. Or they're using channeling money through 501c4s, nonprofits, and then the nonprofit gives the money to the super PAC, so you cannot track the money back to its origin. Now, campaign finance has technically not become a complete free-for-all. There's still technically a limit on how large a check the Koch brothers can write to a candidate running for office. But now the Koch brothers can and have created their own super PACs that can advocate for or against a candidate. As a former Republican FEC member said, It just takes a random billionaire to change a race and maybe change the country. That's what's so radically different now. And I would posit that that's what happened in the Trump campaign when the Mercer family took over and brought in Steve Bannon, Kellyanne Conway, and Steve Miller and started using Cambridge Analytica and doing that sort of in-depth analysis of voters. That's changed the course of the election. One random nutcase billionaire. There have been some efforts toward campaign finance reform. I'm a co-sponsor of a number of bills aimed at ending Citizens United, ending their impact. There's a Democracy for All amendment, change the Constitution to place a limit on campaign spending, amend the Constitution to clarify rights belong to people, not corporations. And absent constitutional amendments, difficult to do, there's the Disclose Act, which requires any corporation, union, or other group to report campaign spending over $10,000 to the FEC within 24 hours. However, not likely that this Congress or this president are going to support those sorts of reforms. Meanwhile, super PACs keep growing. In the 2012 election cycle, super PACs raised a little over $828 million. That's 2012. 2016, that was $1.7 billion, more than doubled. And of that $1.7 billion, 10 people contributed 20% of that amount. 10 people. That's an average of $34 million per person. Now, Justice Stevens said in his dissenting opinion on Citizens United, "This ruling threatens to undermine the integrity of elected institutions across the nation. Americans may be forgiven if they do not feel the court has advanced the cause of self-government today." Now, at least with super PACs, it's difficult, but unless they disguise the route there, you can find out who the donors are, or at least follow it back to Shell Corporation. But now what we have is a huge rise in social welfare groups, 501c4s that are theoretically regulated by the Internal Revenue Service not to spend a predominant amount of their money on political activities, but the IRS really messed that up. At the rise of the Tea Party, they started to just target and said, a number of us for years had said, you got to go after 501c4s. We didn't say go after right-wing five. We said go after all the 501c4s. This is becoming a huge and growing problem. Unfortunately, they decided, some rogue folks in the agency, just to go after Tea Party organizations predominantly, and that became a huge scandal, and now the IRS is afraid to do anything to try and regulate 501c4s. So they are running rampant. They don't have to disclose their donors, no limit on the amount of contributions, and they can engage in political activities as long as they do not become their primary purpose. Well, that's not enforced. There's a new 501c4, Making America Great, funded by mega donor Rebecca Mercer, which is spending money in states around the country where Democrat senators are up for re-election to tout the great accomplishments of the Trump administration and essentially begin the campaign against those Democrats now, early on in 2017. And they have an extreme focus on the Supreme Court. It's estimated that one social welfare group, the Judicial Crisis Center, spent at least $10 million to support the nomination of Neil Gorsuch. They also spent at least $7 million opposing Merrick Garland. Now, just look at that, and for those on the radio, my apologies, you can't see it, but there's just a cheerful young woman at the swearing-in ceremony at the White House on a beautiful day tweeting how great this all is. And she is the chief counsel and policy director of the so-called Judicial Crisis Center. There is a single anonymous donor who gives money to who is suspected to be a Koch, who gives money to the Wellspring Committee, who gives all the money to the Judicial Crisis Network, and then they spent $17 million attempting to manipulate our appointment to the Supreme Court, ultimately successfully. Dark money spending on elections, 501c4 and 501c6, was $5.2 million in 2006, $300 million in 2012. We don't have the numbers yet for 16, but I expect they are going to be astronomical. We need to scrutinize these groups from any perspective, no matter what political direction they're coming from, and bring them to heel. But you know, but according to the Supreme Court, they're not doing anything wrong. They're simply exercising their right to free speech. So where is all this money coming from? Well, conservatives say, oh, it's big labor unions, reckless overspending. They're trying to take over the country. Well, let's look at that issue. Here we have, this is way back in 2012, top 10 unions, 11 million roughly members, spent $153 million, it's $14 a person. Same election, the Koch brothers spent more than $400 million. So two guys, $200 million each, 11 million union members, and of course they dramatically outspent the unions, but it's big union that's the problem. Now, we move on to the 2016 election. Whoa, things are getting a little worse even. Here we go. The Koch brothers this time spent $750 million, nearly $1 billion, $375 million each. And the unions spent, wow, their spending was way up to $182 million. That was $16 per member. They only got outspent by about $570 million by the Koch brothers. So you can see that we've really got to rein in these unions. The largest union donor in 16 was SEIU. They gave $54 million in PAC donations and outside spending. That's about $28 a member. You know, there are 14 million American dues-paying union members, but there's only two Koch brothers, and they're dramatically outspending them. You know, the unions are tipping the scales, they say. Well, you know, there's a couple of key differences. Even if there was some vague parity between the Koch brothers and other super PACs and unions of differences, corporations can now, if they're controlled by an individual or by a board that's willing, can take shareholder money and just dump it into political campaigns. The shareholders don't have anything to say about it. You know, in fact, in unions, it's voluntary to make a political contribution, voluntary. And that is where their campaign spending comes from, voluntary contributions. Now, dues are for representation by the union, of course, are mandatory for now. But I fully expect that following in the footsteps of Scott Walker, the Supreme Court will soon rule that you know, you cannot, even though the union is representing all your interests in terms of your wages and your benefits and your working conditions and you know, whenever you know, a grievance is filed, you can't make me pay, you can't have mandatory dues. And that is just to try and further diminish the clout of unions who are already spending at a fraction the level of these people who have an agenda and who are few in number. In the top five super PAC donors in 2017 after the Koch brothers, top five gave $210 million, $42 million per person. Now, so obviously we got a big problem with the way our elections are financed, but there's other issues. You know, the want to talk about the rise of partisanship and you know, some of the reasons for that. You know, as a nation, every year Democrats and Republicans are moving further and further apart. There's been some interesting books written recently. Again, a slide that you can't see on the radio. Sorry. But in 1994, only 16% of Democrats held a very unfavorable view of Republicans. 2014, 38%, very unfavorable, 79% unfavorable. On the Republican side, 1994, 17% very unfavorable views of Dems. In 14, 43%, and generally unfavorable, 82%. You know, you can see on another slide, which you can't see on the radio, sorry, that the median Democrat and median Republican in 1994 were not worlds apart. It was a different time in Congress. These are and in the nation. But since then, you can see that those two median lines in 14 have moved further and further apart. So there's less common ground than ever before. There used to be a fair amount of overlap between the two parties, but that has diminished dramatically. And it's, you know, it's not just among the American people in attitudes. It's certainly either Congress is a symptom or Congress is a cause, and that's not actually easy to quantify. But, you know, 40 years ago, many that you can see the clusters here sort of toward the middle of these charts, and very few people at the far extremes back in the 70s. But if you come up to the last slide, the last part of the slide here, you can see the movement apart. And if you look between the red and the blue on the bottom slide there, you can see they don't even touch on the House side. There's a huge gap in between. And on the Senate side, there's very few in that that middle area. You know, we, you know, President Trump was supposed to be the post, you know, partisan president, the master negotiator, but unfortunately squandered any opportunity to bring us back together by beginning immediately to govern only to please his base, which is a small percentage of the people in this country. Now, you know, this really, it begins in the House. Has to do with the practice of gerrymandering. Gerrymandering refers to the drawing of representative districts to enhance partisan performance. It's become incredibly scientific, or capture more Democratic or Republican votes rather than reflecting community interests or demographics of an area. I'll get back to this in a few minutes, and again, you can't see it on the radio, but this is the current congressional map, and it's pretty messy, especially if you look down in the Midwest and the South, and I'll address that in a moment. Now, who draws the lines? Well, the party in power. Pennsylvania is kind of a poster child here. In 2010, prior to the last round of redistricting, Republicans poured money into state legislative races to ensure they would be the ones drawing the districts, and 2010 was a bad year for Democrats, and they won all across the country. But particularly, Pennsylvania is kind of a poster child. You know, Obama carried Pennsylvania in 2012 by 300,000 votes. Democrat congressional candidates received 100,000 more votes than Republicans. But Republicans won 13 of the 18 seats. In other words, 51% of the vote equated to 28% of the seats in Pennsylvania representing their interests in the House of Representatives in Washington, D.C. Some of these districts, this is a good one here. This is Pat Meehan's district. The dark blue is the district. You can see it's kind of weird looking, to put it mildly. We can say that definitely would probably represent a community of interest, and that interest being a partisan outcome in the election. And not only Republicans are guilty. This is drawn in Illinois. That's Luis Gutierrez's district. Again, kind of an odd-looking district, to put it mildly. With their victories in 10, pretty much the Republicans have the upper hand till 2020 in the House of Representatives. Charlie Cook, the nation's premier political analyst, has said that it would take a D+7 wave for Democrats to regain the House majority. Furthermore, that means that most congressional elections have become, they're not competitive. There's approximately 65 out of 435 seats in Congress that are swing districts, competitive districts. I represent one. Kurt Schrader has one. That was well demonstrated in the election. My district was the most narrowly divided in the country on the presidential race, Hillary winning by 554 votes. 65 out of 435 are competitive. What does that mean? Well, that means that you're only worried about your primary. And that's sort of a new vocabulary in Washington, particularly on the Republican side of the aisle, worried about the Tea Party. They say, I can't do that, I'll get primaried, which means, you've got to stick with your base because the general election is meaningless in that district absent some massive catastrophic election wave. And that, of course, gave rise to both the Tea Party and now they have the Freedom Caucus. in the House, which is the extreme right wing, and we'll see demonstrated some of their influence next week in the new version of the so-called American Health Care Act. I don't have time to go into how bad that is, but you can find some stuff I put online about it. That has really moved things apart. And, you know, the only time we've seen recently a compromise across the aisle on a major issue was by Speaker John Boehner, and that was the end of his career as Speaker because he couldn't get it past his ultra-right wing nuts and do a budget. So he came to the Democrats, and we got a kind of decent budget, not my priorities, but not bad. But then he had to resign. Now, I don't know what's going to happen next week because they're both going to try and pass a really bad health care bill and fund the government. So who knows? We might have a new speaker the week after next because I think they're going to have to come to the Democratic side to get votes to get either. I mean, first off, we're not voting for their health care bill as written. But if they want to fix the Affordable Care Act, it does need some work. A number of states have taken matters into their own hands. California, Arizona, Washington, Idaho, Montana, Hawaii, New Jersey. They have independent redistricting commissions. Before that, California was one of the worst offenders, famously the Burton brothers. John or Phil, I always get them mixed up, drew a district for his brother that was connected by waterways and rail lines. Not exactly, you know, what were considered to be lines of connection or transportation for people. But in 2008, California approved an initiative and set up independent commissions. They're forbidden to consider anything except compactness and community of interest, nothing on a partisan basis. Until that commission redistricted the state, the reelection rate was 99.6%. But after redistricting, one quarter of California incumbent members of Congress either were retired or they retired. It did make a difference. So citizen-led redistricting can work. We haven't gerrymandered in particular. In fact, the last time we did redistricting, the first time we didn't go to court, we had a split House, 50-50, which may have led to something that didn't have to be litigated. But I believe that the whole country would benefit if we expanded this nationwide. Here now we move to the issue. Here's the current congressional district map. Again, can't see it on the radio, but it's really messy looking. And here is what a community of interest compact district map would look like. I mean, look at the difference here, particularly when you look at the Midwest and the South. This just looks a lot more rational than the current system. There's a bill in Congress, actually, to mandate that the states have, that they all have independent commissions. Zoe Lofgren from California has introduced it, and I'm on that bill. Now, there's another issue, which is the media and how people get their information. Certainly a lot's been written about this in the last campaign. You know, there's a quaint thing now, very historic artifact. It was called the Fairness Doctrine. Broadcast media had to present both sides of an issue. Went away during the Reagan years. God bless her. One of my colleagues, Louise Slaughter, has introduced a bill every year to reinstate it. We've never gotten anywhere with it, but it's a quaint notion, to say the least. Interesting, last year, Facebook was hauled before Congress because it was alleged that they had been suppressing conservative sites on their trending stories to emphasize more liberal sites. And, you know, many lawmakers were demanding answers from Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, but of course they're the same people who are opposed to the Fairness Doctrine. So they're talking out of both sides of their mouths, at least. With the rise of cable news and that and bloggers, the degradation of broadcast media, independent journalism is rare and hard to find. And really, this all got even worse. Fairness Doctrine was bad enough, but then the telecommunications deregulation of 1996. We used to have restrictions on cross-ownership. That is, if you were in, like, Eugene, you couldn't own the Eugene Register Guard and own a TV station and own a radio station. The telecommunications deregulation did away with cross-ownership restrictions. There was also another restriction that said you can't dominate a market, essentially sort of an antitrust thing. That went away with the telecommunications deregulation. This was touted widely by, particularly by Al Gore, as the greatest thing since sliced bread. I was one of 16 members of the House to vote against it. I predicted this would not go well, and it certainly hasn't. Hence the Fox Empire and other concentrated ownership of our media and the loss of independent media. So, fair and balanced is kind of hard to find these days. So, that's another issue. And then one other issue that relates to the most cutting edge and modern uses of media, which relates to the internet, is predictive analytics. We don't know, but there are those who say that Cambridge Analytica and its work on the Trump campaign made the difference. Because we have virtually no privacy rights in this country. I mean, if you sign on to Google or Facebook, have you read the contract? And then, of course, the Republicans just rescinded restrictions on our internet service providers from tracking every single thing we do and selling it to whoever wants to buy it. And this company, Cambridge Analytica, developed algorithms and did micro-targeting down to the point where Haitians in Miami were getting Facebook posts demonstrating the failure of the Clinton Foundation to help after the earthquake in Haiti. I mean, this is the level to which and the sophistication to which they were manipulating voters. So this is a whole new threat to our future of representative democracy. And then, of course, there's the whole issue, what about voting? Well, that's getting a little bit harder, too. We are seeing voter suppression legislation, and again, the activist right-wing Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder, took away Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. States which had a pattern of discrimination, if they were going to change anything that related to the voting, they had to get approval from the Justice Department. Well, the Supreme Court threw that out. It looked for a moment that in Congress, when the Republican chairman of the Judiciary Committee said, well, wait a minute, that, we can't go there. He's from Wisconsin. But in the end, the bill to restore those protections got bottled up, never went anywhere. We now have continual fights. The last administration fought. The Justice Department would go in and file litigation. This administration probably, with Jeff Sessions, not so much. North Carolina was a poster child for this. They eliminated same-day registration, early voting hours, moved polling places, and it obviously primarily affected African Americans. And a relatively conservative circuit court said that the changes Republican-led legislature made to the existing law targeted African-American voters with almost surgical precision. So they were overturned. Maricopa County, Arizona, funny, no polling places in the more liberal areas and an oversupply in the conservative areas. Again, something that would have had to been cleared with the Justice Department in the old days, but not now. And then the presidential election. This is not truly representative either. On my side as a Democrat, we have these superdelegates, which are an artifact of the fight between Kennedy and Carter, and the party bosses saying, wait a minute, we used to decide all this stuff in a smoke-filled room. Now all these, why we can't influence this. So they created superdelegates, 712. Every elected, federally elected official is a superdelegate. But then there are many, many, many more. And none of these superdelegates are pledged to vote for anybody. They are an independent entity. They, in fact, some of them are fake. They represent fake groups. The DNC created fake groups, and there's a senior group, and the chair and vice chair get to be delegates. I said, I'm a senior specialist. What's this group? I've never heard of them. And you look them up. Yeah, they don't really exist. This is all made up stuff. So there are a number of us who are pushing to do away with superdelegates. I would compromise and say, yeah, you can keep two from each state, the chair of the party and the vice chair of the party, because they dedicate and volunteer a lot of time. But beyond that, this system should not exist. And then we go to the Electoral College. 3 million more people voted for Hillary Clinton than Donald Trump. And back in the Gore v. Bush, it was only 500,000 people. But in both cases, the Electoral College brought us the person who got fewer votes. Now, and they still teach this in some political science classes. I've had arguments with, small states benefit from this. Well, yeah, and you'd never see a presidential candidate. Well, did we see any? No. I mean, they're targeting swing states only. But what it does do is give an inordinate weight to the smallest of the small states in this country. I mean, look at it this way. Wyoming, population 580,000 people. I have 775,000 people in my congressional district. If you're in my congressional district, you get 1.4 electoral votes, one representative, and you get 2/5 of each senator. So that's 1.4 electoral votes. If you live in Wyoming, fewer people than live in my district, you get 3 electoral votes. So obviously, it's going to be difficult to get a constitutional amendment through 2/3 of the states to abolish the Electoral College, but luckily there's a workaround. The workaround is, the popular vote interstate compact. 10 states have agreed to it, who have a total thus far of 165 electoral votes. It's pending in 23 states. It's pending in Oregon, although State Senate President Peter Courtney has said he will not hear it. But maybe he needs to hear from some people. Because when we get to 270 votes, those states will bind their electors to vote for the person who gets the majority in the popular vote nationwide. We can undo and get around the Electoral College without amending the Constitution. So, I've laid out a lot of problems, and I know it's kind of depressing, but I'm still there fighting, and I hope you're ready to continue to help in that. Obviously we've got to reform the way that we fund elections top to bottom. We need to repair the Voting Rights Act and undo the damage from Shelby versus Holder. There is actually some faint hope in the courts. There are two cases before the Supreme Court from Virginia and North Carolina which relate to the 14th Amendment and in terms of equal protection, and then there's another case which is going to come to the Supreme Court in Wisconsin, which is called Whitfield versus Gill. And this is a novel circuit court interpretation, but I think it's right on point. They are saying this isn't a 14th Amendment issue. It's a First Amendment issue, freedom of association. Because of packing people into districts, you have diminished the value of people's vote. It is not one person, one vote, because you've packed all the Democrats into a few districts, so their votes are diminished in terms of the overall outcome, just like we talked about in Pennsylvania. Even though Democrats get a bunch more votes statewide, they get a tiny fraction of the seats in the legislature in the state. This is a big deal case. Now, with the Supreme Court, I'm not holding my breath, but should that happen, that would undo much of this gerrymandering without having to pass legislation nationally. As I said earlier, we've got to do away with the Electoral College, and we've got to strengthen privacy protections. I mean, this new disturbing trend with the micro-targeting and the predictive analytics the premier company doing this being owned by the right-wing billionaire from Wall Street, Mr. Mercer, who also owns Breitbart, who brought us all those folks in the White House, or his daughter did. He's a misanthrope. He doesn't like to talk to people. He just gives her the money. But, there is other hope. Some of you were there. My colleagues were doing a lot of town meetings, and what I was getting from people was they want to know what to do. They don't want to just hear about issues.
And at a town meeting, I can only talk about issues. I can't talk about here's how we can change things and here's, you know, how you can work on elections. So I decided to hold community forums. My colleagues were skeptical until I held them. And the first one in Eugene, we started out down at the shed, and then we had RSVPs phone in, and we didn't do any advertising. We worked with Our Revolution and Indivisible and my own social media. And my staff kept calling saying, yeah, we need a bigger place. And finally I said, get the biggest place you can. And they did, and it was a Lane Community College gymnasium. And we had 2,400 people show up there. And when I said, how many of you have never been really politically active before, more than half the people stood up. Same result in Corvallis, same result in Coos Bay, same result in Canyonville. So the American people have kind of awakened from a slumber. They're not taking for granted anymore that, you know, we're going to have a kind of a balanced representative system in this country. And it's working to some extent. Certainly, that's what stopped the so-called American Health Care Act when people started showing up at Republican town halls and saying, wait a minute, you're taking away my health care. The Affordable Care Act is more popular today than any time since it passed 7 years ago, because it's kind of like the Joni Mitchell song, you don't know what you got till it's gone. And, so suddenly that's changed. The Muslim ban, we had the ACLU supported by a spontaneous outpouring of hundreds of thousands of people across the country at airports and city halls and federal buildings. That forced the Trump administration after their first injunction to modify it, and they're still under yet another court injunction. So, this is making an impact. And then just this week in Georgia, we saw a seat that was formerly held by Newt Gingrich, has been held by Republicans for 40 years, where a neophyte young former staffer almost won in a jungle primary. He got 48.1% of the vote. And this is going to go to a runoff. And that was after having about $10 million, not spent in favor of the 11 Republican candidates, $10 million targeted, $3 million from my speaker alone, Paul Ryan, against the Democratic candidate. So that is going to be a knockdown, drug-out slugfest. I don't know how far I can go with the City Club, but if you can contact my campaign, and you can actually phone bank into Georgia. We're setting up systems like that. And if you want to get out and volunteer at one of the 7 seats that we're targeting in California, you can do that too. So we are going to use the new engagement and the energy of people to change things. So this is a difficult time. But it's also an exciting time with this new energy. I haven't given up hope yet, and neither should you. So thanks for being here today, and let's keep on trying. Thank you very much.
We have the privilege to bring somebody to be the first questioner. Thank you, Representative Fazio, for your insights. Now, the first questioner is Manju Bangalore, an aspiring astronaut. She's a junior here at the University of Oregon pursuing a dual degrees in physics and math. She is a Wayne Morse scholar and has worked at NASA in the White House. Ms. Bangalore is also a founder and executive director of Rosie, a local menstrual health nonprofit. She is a strong advocate for science, literacy, and getting more women and minorities into the STEM programs. Now, welcome, Ms. Bangalore, to the microphone.
Hi, Representative DeFazio. Thank you so much for being here on behalf of everyone. This morning at 10 a.m., I got an email from your office about March for Science. I will be marching tomorrow, as I'm sure many of you guys will be. In the email, there was a bold statement that said we should be standing up for evidence-based science policy. And as a young scientist, I was really happy to see that my representative was saying that. My question, and I'm curious about your stance regarding mandatory labeling for GMOs. Oh. Current science says that commercially available GMOs are safe for consumption. Not only that, but GMOs are one of our best bets in addressing malnutrition and world hunger. So my question to you is, why do you support mandatory labeling of GMOs if the evidence-based science says that they are safe for consumption?
Well, I think that if you look at the very consistent polling, absent when one of these initiatives gets on the ballot and Monsanto and others spend tens of millions of dollars against it, in consistent polling, 75-80% of the American people say they want to know whether the food contains GMOs and make their own decisions about whether or not they want to consume a food which contains GMOs. So, you know, and some of the GMO experiments, you know, particularly those that relate to salmon, where we're crossing salmon with Arctic char, and they will grow much faster than regular salmon, and should they get into the environment, they would destroy our native runs of salmon because the way salmon select and mate. So, you know, I see things as that. You may say, gee, well, the flesh isn't quantitatively different because it's a GMO, but the GMO organism itself, particularly a living organism like a salmon, you know, presents a threat to the environment and the perpetuation of the species as we know it. And they say, don't worry, they won't get out, and most of them are sterile. That's what the people who do this. And I say, yeah, okay, that gives me great, you know, cause. So, and I've heard, and I've had an argument with a professor from OSU. He's saying, you know, yellow, there's some kind of rice that, my God, it can be grown so easily. People don't like it the way it tastes. I mean, it's been rejected by consumers. So the bottom line is consumers should have a choice. And if, you know, if GMOs are insignificant to you, then fine. But you should not have to pull out your phone and get a Q reader to find out, and that was the compromise of the Obama administration, because the industry said we cannot possibly have all these different labels, except when I brought a Hershey bar wrapper blown up to the floor of the House of Representatives during the debate. It was in Europe. It had an American flag on it. It said made in the USA, and over in this corner it says contains GMOs. But they can't do that here. So I think consumers have a right to know.
I agree that we should be skeptical, like we should come in to science being skeptical and demand evidence for the technologies being produced. But, and I agree that consumers have a right to know, but isn't it disingenuous to have a label that says made with GMOs without also saying that GMOs, this GMO is safe for consumption? Isn't that creating almost
Well, we say that food dye number X is safe. We say this is safe. Read a label. Look at all the junk that's on there. When I see all that junk, I don't want to buy it. And this is just one more thing on a label disclosing how it was made and what's in it. And you know, I mean, originally in Britain, the industry wanted this because they thought it would be great with consumers, but then they found out consumers were skeptical. So as a scientist, it'll be your job to educate people that this is really great and they should want to eat GMOs. As a politician, I'm representing a very substantial majority view and saying, I just want you to know what's in your food and make your own choice.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we're going to do the Q&A. We're going to start on this side.
Congressman DeFazio, thank you very much for coming today, and thank you for representing us. Mm-hmm. I'm John Belcher. I've been a City Club member since 1999. My question is about small starts. We've been very successful in getting 3MX lines thus far. We're hoping for the fourth. That requires funding from small starts. My question is, what do you foresee as the future, and how can we make sure it still stays viable?
Well, of course, in the long-term FAST Act, we authorize continuation of small starts, but they are appropriated. They're not mandatory. And the Trump skinny budget would zero out small starts. It would cut $4 billion out of real infrastructure investments, including small starts. And the excuse of Mr. Mulvaney, the head of the Trump Office of Management Budget, is, well, we want to cut $4 billion out of infrastructure now because we're going to spend it better later. Well, you know, my experience in Washington, D.C. later never happened, so I'm totally opposed to the cuts. I don't think Congress will go there. We've authorized them, and then we're just going to have to twist the arms of the appropriator to fund them. But they benefit dozens of cities all around America, and there's tremendous demand for them, so I'm hopeful that we'll maintain them.
Bob Cassidy. Peter, is it at all possible that the conflict on the health care bill could be resolved by providing Part A of Medicare to the entire population and then work out the other coverages at a later time?
Well, of course, Part A only covers hospitalization, and you know, generally, it, you know, we know these days that you want to have as much prevention and maintenance as possible to keep people out of hospitals. So, extending a benefit that only covers hospitalization, I think would be a mistake. You know, the Affordable Care Act had many problems because we ended up with the Senate version of the bill. The House bill was much better, and I proposed one of the key elements of the House bill that would fix many of the problems. The problems are particularly in individual markets with high premiums, and some places there's only one plan, and high deductibles. The House bill had national exchanges instead of state exchanges, obviously much larger groups. That brings down the costs. And the House bill had a national, not-for-profit, government-run plan that would be available nationwide to anybody who wanted to buy it, and I'm sure it would outcompete the private plans. And in my mind, and I've introduced the bill, say this will fix the problems you're talking about, that would ultimately demonstrate how well a single-payer plan could work. But Medicare itself needs some work because right now, with the Affordable Care Act, the exhaustion of the Medicare Trust Fund is 2028. If they repeal the Affordable Care Act, the Medicare Trust Fund will be exhausted in 2024. And we aren't allowed to negotiate lower prices for prescription drugs. I've also introduced a bill on that to say let's rescind the prohibition on negotiating lower prices for prescription drugs, which costs Medicare $1 billion a year or so. And just a little tongue-in-cheek, I said, but we need someone to negotiate, so I appointed the president as the negotiator since he's such a great negotiator with my bill. So.
We just had two city club members ask a question. We're going to stick on this side, and I'll come back to you, Sandy.
Sure.
Go right ahead.
Thank you. I'm Diane Conrad. What are your thoughts about calling a limited constitutional convention to overturn Citizens United?
I'm not a legal scholar, but I am friendly with some who are constitutional scholars, and they believe there is no way to limit a constitutional convention once it's convened. It would set its own rules and do whatever it wanted to the Bill of Rights and the Constitution and remand it back to the states. So.
Yes, Sandy Erickson, City Club member. First, I'd like to say that on July 23rd, City Club is giving a program on the national public vote contract. And so there's hope.
Yeah.
My question has to do with some a subject that is getting some ink in national magazines, and it's a Halls of Washington question. There is a proposition that the whole Trump disinformation tweeting thing is a orchestrated campaign to obscure the truth, to prevent people from knowing what is actually happening, and to prevent ultimate public accountability. And so I would want to know, is Trump really just filterless, or is it seem in Washington, you know, behind the scenes, that there is a highly sophisticated disinformation campaign going on?
Well, I think there is a very highly sophisticated disinformation campaign going on, and sometimes things show up. I can't remember what it was, but there was something that the sourcing was one ultra-right-wing radio talk show host. Then it was repeated. It was one of many Trump's many allegations that was a blockbuster that wiped something else off the media for 3 or 4 days when the heat was on. And it just happened to get published in Breitbart News. And, of course, Steve Bannon just happens to have run Breitbart News. And then Trump just happened to read Breitbart News and then cited that as a source for whatever this particular thing was. I think it was either – it was probably the wiretapping, yeah. And I do think that we're seeing a very sophisticated campaign. I would go further. Did we wag the dog? What was the thing? I mean, Assad is a loathsome dictator, and he has used poison gas in the past. Why would he use it now? I don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But the point is, we shot 60 Tomahawk missiles. You can land a Tomahawk missile on this podium. And somehow, we were going to send a message, and we were going to keep him from brutalizing his people. First, we called the Russians and said, oh, by the way, get out of the airbase. They probably told the Syrians, who put all the planes in hardened hangars. And then we have weapons that will disable runways, so you can't use them anymore. Strangely enough, we didn't use a single one of those warheads, and we didn't disable anything permanently. But that blew something else off the front pages. I think it was the Russian connection, because now the Russians are mad at Trump. Are they really? I don't know. You know, my reading list for the Trump era, it took me a while to get the second one because I had 1984, I had my copy forever. but the second one was The Manchurian Candidate, and that's my reading list for the Trump era. So.
Decide? Go ahead.
Yeah, Representative DeFazio, speaking of The Manchurian Candidate, I'm glad this has come up in the discussion because I feel like, you know, I was born after the Nixon era. It's history to me. And we've been discussing Nixon in our constitutional law classes here in this room. Where is this going? And what, you know, what is your position on what should happen? The inquiry into the ties with Russia, I mean.
Well, I'm on a bill that would create an independent commission to investigate. Secondly, a little known chapter of the downfall of Nixon was the Ways and Means Committee demanded his taxes. And he had some problems in his taxes. And that hastened his leaving the White House. So on the first day of the first meeting of the Ways and Means Committee, a friend of mine, wonderful old curmudgeon, former mayor of Paterson, New Jersey, Bill Pascrell, had done a little research. He said, yeah, we can get anybody's taxes. And they, what they do is the committee votes to get them. They review them in executive session. And if they believe it's in the public interest to release them, they can release anybody's taxes, but they first have to review them in an executive session. So Bill discovered this, and they were just organizing, and he made a privilege motion. The chairs, you know, whatever. And Bill says, you know, Mr. Chairman, I move that, you know, we subpoena the president's taxes. And the chairman, whose mic was open, said, oh, shit. But then they proceeded, after a long, rancorous debate, to have a partisan vote and not demand his tax. The taxes are really key. There are some random quotes from one of his kids about 5 or 7 years ago in the New York Times after the collapse of Wall Street saying, and after one of his bankruptcies saying, we're getting a lot of money from the Russians. Boy, these guys, you don't want to mess around with them. They're bad guys. So how indebted is he to who? In Russia, and that we, you know, breaking any all precedents by not releasing his taxes, you know, we've tried privilege motions of the House and that, and until we see that, we won't really know. And then, you know, there's questions of the emoluments clause that come to his properties. That's another issue. He's clearly, in my mind, but not the new acting head of GSA, benefiting from the lease of the Trump Hotel in Washington, D.C., and we've had a clause in every federal lease since the carpetbagger era after the Civil War saying no elected official can benefit from these leases, standard clause. And this the guy who was head of GSA acting suddenly gets strangely assigned to go work in a nonprofit in D.C. with his full salary, which is a lot of money. And he's like a GS-14. And then the next guy in line took over, and he wrote back to me and Elijah Cummings, who'd been pushing this issue since the election, saying, oh, well, Trump isn't benefiting because the money is going into trusts, and the trusts can only spend the money to pay down the debt or to improve the property, so he's not benefiting from it. Huh? So anyway, they are being sued by a public interest group, so we'll see what comes of that. Maybe there's some integrity in the courts.
All right, now decide.
A quick two-part question about current funding. Since our government, our federal government, is only funded through next month, how do you see this being addressed when you get back to Washington? And secondly, what is your sense of how Congress will respond to the priorities outlined in the president's budget request? Is there any hope of staving off any of the $54 billion in proposed cuts, especially those related to volunteer-driven services, science, natural resources, and the environment?
This is the so-called Trump skinny budget, and the Republicans declared it dead on arrival. We didn't even really have to speak up. You know, the government funding runs out next Friday, and the issue, you know, Trump is insisting on the wall. If the wall's in there, the Democrats aren't going to support it. The right wing is insisting on defunding Planned Parenthood. If that's in there, we're not going to vote for it. And if he gets a $30 billion extra payment to the DOD, remember last fall it came out, no one noticed it because the election was going on. The DOD had a report that said that they had wasted $150 billion administratively. And they are the only agency of the federal government that has not ever been audited and is not auditable. One day on one appropriations bill, very late at night when the chairman didn't know what we were doing, a Republican from New Jersey and I passed an amendment to require an audit of the Pentagon. And then later, when they found out that that's what we'd done, of course, it disappeared in the conference committee. So dumping more money into the Pentagon when we can't even audit them and we have reports that they've wasted $150 billion is not a starter with me or many other Democrats. So, thank you.
Now, please help me thank once again Congressman Peter DeFazio for his service. This is only maybe the second or third time I've seen a standing ovation, and thank you again for your continued service. My name is Juan Carlos Valle, and this concludes today's program.